Hours 20 UTC, 7:20 p.m. in Zimbabwe on Saturday, September 12th, 2015. You're listening to Studio 7 live from the Voice of America in Washington. Thank you for joining us live from Washington. This is Kip Stube. Here are our top stories this evening. Occupy Africa Unity Square activists say President Robert Mugabe has not yet responded to a petition they submitted to his office a few weeks ago, urging him to press national security agents to look for Itai Dzamara.
We are engaging the government, trying by all means to see whether the police as ordered by the court are doing anything up to date.
Former Vice President Joyce Mujuru, who this week released a manifesto to transform Zimbabwe's declining economy, has been warned to prepare for a grueling fight with ZANU-PF.
Anyone who actually stands for democracy is branded a puppet of the West. We say to Mujuru, welcome to what you have been told before. Now that you're calling your party a national democrat.
Today we speak to a Zimbabwean who is currently in the USA under a program catering for the needs of communities.
We are about 32 from about 30 countries, and our chances of getting into the fellowship were from 1,500 participants.
And in the Women's Forum, we are discussing the impact of HIV/AIDS on women. These stories and much, much more coming up. Occupy Africa Unity Square activists say President Robert Mugabe has not yet responded to a petition they submitted to his office a few weeks ago, urging him to press national security agents to look for Itai Dzamara, who disappeared 5 months ago. Dzamara was abducted by unknown assailants after staging several protests in Harare, urging the president to step down for allegedly failing to properly run Zimbabwe. The High Court ordered state security agents to look for him and submit reports to relevant authorities. Charles Nyoni of Occupy Africa Unity Square tells Studio 7 it is said that Dzamara is still missing 5 months after his alleged abduction.
We are continuing with our process of prayer as well as preparation for the commemoration of the day that Itai wrote the petition, which is 17 October at an advanced stage.
So now, talking about these rallies that you are always holding, are they having any impact at all?
Yes, they are, because they are keeping people aware as well as informing people that there is a person that is still missing, as well as helping to put pressure on the government because of the coverage, press coverage that they generate. It is due to this prayer rallies that the state decided to give attention to the whole Itai Dzamara issue. Because if you recall, at first they didn't want to comment or to say anything, or even to agree with us that Itai was abducted or is missing, whichever way they want to put it. But because of this prayer rallies, now they are forced to comment as well as to set their position exactly where they are.
Are you in any way engaging the government? Because last time we saw you presenting a petition to the president's office, did you get any feedback from him?
Not yet at the moment. Yes, we are engaging the government, trying by all means to see whether the police as ordered by the court are doing anything up to date.
Is there any way that you can follow up your kind of petition?
Yes, there is. We are actually currently planning to up our gears a bit, so that instead of just doing rallies, we come up with something else on the ground that would surely put the government to pressure and to charge.
So now, looking at the court order, which actually compelled the security forces to look for Mr. Dzamara, do you have any contact with the security forces in any way to find out exactly what is going on?
Yes, the lawyers currently are engaging the police officers to find out how far they are gone, as well as to demand another feedback from one that they claim that they have done.
That was Charles Nyoni of Occupy Africa Unity Square speaking with Studio 7 from Harare. Former Vice President Joyce Mujuru, who this week released a manifesto to transform Zimbabwe's declining economy, has been warned to prepare for a grueling fight with ZANU-PF. Andrew Chaponda of the MDCT USA provincial executive says while they are happy about Mrs. Mjuru's move to fight against her former mentor, President Robert Mugabe, it is just a matter of time before the ruling party accuses her of being a puppet of the West. Chaponda tells Studio 7 that Mrs. Mjuru should brace for a bruising battle with her former handlers, who have in the past claimed that the MDCT is a puppet of the West.
Mujuru has been a member of ZANU-PF since, I may say, conception, because she says that she is the daughter of one R.G. Mugabe. So Mujuru has never known any other political party other than ZANU-PF. Now that she has come out and says she is no longer part of ZANU-PF, my question to Mujuru would be, what is it that you did during your tenure as a card-carrying member and also as a minister in the government of ZANU-PF and as vice president in ZANU-PF, and over the 35 years that you have been a senior government official within the ZANU-PF? So for her to come out now and say now that she's a Democrat, we welcome that. But from the MDC perspective, with our big tent approach, everybody who espouses democratic values and principles of which the MDC has always stood for, we welcome that. But we still have to make sure that this whole new project that Mujuru and the other people who have been allegedly been thrown out of ZANU-PF are now espousing is indeed a people's project. We welcome them. There's now more voices calling for a free and fair election in Zimbabwe.
There's a danger here that if Mrs. Mjuru doesn't form a coalition with the MDCT, the MDCT may actually collapse, because indications are that people may support her instead of the MDC. What are your views on that?
This is a very erroneous assumption that people are making. The MDC has been around since 1999. Political parties have come and gone. So the coming of Mujuru or the political landscape, welcome as it is, does not pose any threat at all to the MDC. People must be disabused of this idea that Mujuru is going to be a major force that will distract the membership of MDC from supporting the MDC, their party, and their leader, Morgan Tsvangirai. We welcome Mujuru to become an additional player. Mujuru, when she comes, she is coming as an ex-ZANU-PF official. I do not see the people who have been tormented by Mujuru over the years, who are in the MDC ranks, going to join Mujuru. It is their democratic right to do so. But we expect that when Mujuru comes on board, she has to draw most of her membership from ZANU-PF. So I think that question that you posed to me, you should pose it to ZANU-PF, that how do you feel Mujuru going out of ZANU-PF with ZANU-PF members, not the other way around?
And what role should the USA play in such new party formations? Because, you know, ZANU-PF will be very quick to say this is a US project or a Western kind of idea of a party formation.
We have heard that before, that anyone who actually stands for democracy is branded a puppet of the West. We say to Mujuru, welcome to what we have been told before. Now that you're calling your party a National Democrat, ZANU-PF will immediately brand you a puppet of the West. If that is how ZANU-PF has been operating in the past, we simply say to Mujuru, there you are. That's what you have been saying to all of us in the past when we were trying to fight for the rights of ordinary Zimbabweans. So by Mujuru coming on board, we hope that she will not only be able to see it from our own point of view, but she will also be able to tell us how ZANU-PF has been able to rig elections in the past.
That was Andrew Chaponda, MDCT US Provincial Executive, speaking with Studio 7 from Kalamazoo, Michigan, USA. ZANU-PF Chairman Simon Kayamoyo declined to comment. Patience Malava, a Zimbabwean currently in the USA under a program catering for the needs of communities, says she hopes to derive concrete ideas of community empowerment which will be used to transform societies back home. Malava, who is attached to One America, an organization looking into issues affecting immigrants, is expected to complete a six-month stint in Washington, D.C., being imparted with various community engagement skills. She speaks to Studio 7 about the Community Solutions Program run by the International Research and Exchanges Board on behalf of the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs of the U.S. Department of State.
It's a professional development program that is for emerging leaders around the world. We are about 52 from about 30 countries, and our chances of getting into the fellowship were from 1,500 participants. We're applying for it.
What are you doing exactly in Washington, D.C.?
I'm with an organization called One America. The organization works with immigrants communities. They empower immigrants communities in terms of building power in them to stand up for their issues. They seek to redress the immigrants' laws. So they're working mostly on immigrants reform and also just training them, giving them power and bringing them together, organizing them to stand for their own issues. Basically advocacy.
So this kind of organization that you are attached to, does it have any relevance to Zimbabwe?
It has a lot of relevance to Zimbabwe because in Zimbabwe, I'm with an organization called Hapaku Trust, which works on advocacy. So the relevance is that the issues that they are working on are basically the same issues that we work with. The only difference is the context, because they are dealing with issues of social injustice, which is what we are also talking about. They are dealing with issues of access to education because they are addressing the opportunity gap for immigrant communities, which is what we are also dealing with in Zimbabwe. So essentially, the issues have a way in which they are converging. It's just a difference in the context.
Right now, what do you think you have actually derived from this organization, which you think you are going to implement back home?
I am deriving from the organization the skill of influencing policy-making processes and the skill of engaging communities to also be part of the process of influencing policy-making processes, which I think is not there in Zimbabwe. Currently, even if civil society organizations are working towards influencing policy-making process, we are not as practically involved in the policy-making process. The policy-making process is a bit more detached from the communities. It's also a bit more detached from the civil society work.
Yes, give us an insight exactly of what you're talking about here.
Okay, One America organizes the immigrants' communities and also lobbies with the legislators. They're also letting the immigrants' community understand the importance of coming to the platforms that they create. And they create questions for the legislators and ask legislators and make them commit to what they pledge to do in those meetings. And they follow up on that. They ultimately get to a point where they see enactment of the laws that they would have been lobbying for.
Is it possible to do that back home?
Practically, it's not been possible because we are working as Hapaku Trust on creating policy dialogue forums, which have not really essentially been about the actual policymakers. It's mainly been about the local authorities, but not really the actual policymakers. So for me, I think it has not really been practical and is something that has not been done as far as my experience is concerned.
How long are you going to be attached to that organization?
Until December.
That was Patience Malaba of Hapaku Trust speaking with Studio 7 from Washington, D.C. You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
14 years ago, September 11th, 2001, nearly 3,000 men, women, and children from over 90 countries died when terrorists used hijacked civilian aircraft to destroy the World Trade Center in New York City and damage the Pentagon near Washington, D.C. They crashed another civilian airliner in a field in Pennsylvania when the passengers, realizing the hijackers' intent, refused to allow them to attack yet another target and fought back. The world changed that day, not because of the deaths of 3,000 people or because the attack took place in the United States, but because a group of terrorists saw fit to inflict as much damage as possible on random civilian targets. The people who died that day represent a cross-section of ages, ethnicities, and religious affiliations. They had nothing the terrorists wanted, had done nothing to cause harm to their murderers. They died because it is the nature of terrorists to attack those who are least likely and able to fight back, and in that way to cause revulsion and horror in all civilized people. That is why the United States, along with the rest of the global community, confronts terrorism everywhere and advances freedom and democracy as an alternative to the ideologies of hatred and repression.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
As usual, it's now time for the Women's Forum.
How come to the Women's Forum. I am Tato Muchooni, a Mandela Washington Fellow attached with the Voice of America's Zimbabwe services, standing in for Marvelous Mthanga Nyahuye. This evening, our guest is Millicent Shoko, working with people living with HIV. We take a look at HIV and challenges that women face.
Welcome to the show, Mrs. Shoko. Mrs. Shoko, what could you say are factors which make women more vulnerable to HIV infection?
At some point, with the low risk perception by especially married women, that the very low risk perception that they could be infected with HIV, they consider themselves married, and therefore they thought that was a barrier against getting HIV infected. And then also gender disparity issues, you know, the way women do not have these negotiating powers. It's a patriarchal society. The man makes the decisions. It's him who decides when and where and how the sex is done. And that was an issue because, obviously, the man, he's been out there. The woman was not empowered enough to be able to say, you were out there, I cannot have sex with you. He would still say, I paid what is called lobola. And, you know, that was a driving factor. Poverty, maybe not so much as poverty, but, you know, because, you know, the issues of access to resources. Those women were at a time when we had lots of widows, where the breadwinner, the man, has passed her on, and the woman is not working. They have no means of working. And at points like this, this is where you see women going maybe for sex work in order to fend for their families and for themselves.
Is there a good support system for women when it comes to issues of HIV and AIDS in Zimbabwe?
What I know, the support system was there. Like, for instance, you'd have organizations that really, like, targeted women. Maybe I could mention organizations like Msasa, organizations like WASN. Those were supporting women. And then we had other organizations that would provide services, maybe to both women and men. But what has happened over the years, you know, the dwindling or the economic situation has made it not possible to continue to have some of these things. But the support system at some point was there, but because of the economic situation, things have, you know, really like gone down.
Mrs. Shoko, what do you think can be done to give the Zimbabwean women the negotiating power when it comes to sexual engagement?
Personally, I think maybe we've been speaking with the women on their own, and I think that is a problem for a society like ours. We've been looking at maybe when we're sensitizing women, we've been looking at maybe having dialogues where the men are also involved, where they speak about these issues, and they come out to their, you know, with their own resolutions to say, this is a challenge, this is a problem, how do we deal with it? Why is it necessary to deal with it in a certain manner that they decide as a community where both men and women are?
Now, how has it been to bring men to the setting?
It's not easy, very difficult. It's not easy. I know the organization that I'm working for in 2015, we've tried to involve men in HIV programming, more so especially we have this program, the PMTCT program, the Option B+, if you're aware of it, where really it's very important that the men should know, because now when you are pregnant and you are HIV positive, the program sees that you the NC or the mother, the pregnant mother or pregnant woman is put straight away on medication. But because of the system, like the patriarchal system that I'm talking about, she has to go and convince the men now that I have to take this medicine, and you know, they're convinced on art for life. So it's really important that the men is brought on board, but it's not easy.
You were listening to the Women's Forum. I am Tato Muchooni, a Mandela Washington Fellow, attached with the Voice of America Zimbabwe services. Our guest this evening was Millicent Shoko. Good night, Zimbabwe.
Thanks very much, Tato Muchooni. We hope you are going to have a wonderful weekend. Now to recap today's top stories. Occupy Africa Unity Square activists say President Robert Mugabe has not yet responded to a petition they submitted to his office a few weeks ago, urging him to press national security agents to look for Itai Dzamara. And former Vice President Joyce Mujuru, who this week released a manifesto to transform Zimbabwe's declining economy, has been warned to prepare for a grueling fight with ZANU-PF. That's our broadcast this evening. Now stand by for Studio 7 in Ndebele with Chris Gande. This is Gibbs Dube in Washington, D.C., wishing a